This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents The Firm by John Grisham. Read by Scott Brick. Chapter 1. The senior partner studied the resume for the 100th time and again found nothing he disliked about Mitchell Y. McDeer, at least not on paper. He had the brains, the ambition, the good looks, and he was hungry. With his background, he had to be. He was married, and that was mandatory. The firm had never hired an unmarried lawyer, and it frowned heavily on divorce, as well as womanizing and drinking. Drug testing was in the contract. He had a degree in accounting, passed the CPA exam the first time he took it, and wanted to be a tax lawyer, which, of course, was a requirement with a tax firm. He was white, and the firm had never hired a black. They managed this by being secretive and clubbish and never soliciting job applications. Other firms solicited and hired blacks. This firm recruited and remained lily white. Plus, the firm was in Memphis, of all places, and the top blacks wanted New York or Washington or Chicago. McDeer was a male, and there were no women in the firm. That mistake had been made in the mid-70s when they recruited the number one grad from Harvard, who happened to be a she and a wizard at taxation. She lasted 4 turbulent years and was killed in a car wreck. He looked good on paper. He was their top choice. In fact, for this year, there were no other prospects. The list was very short. It was McDeer or no one. The managing partner, Royce McKnight, studied a dossier labeled Mitchell Y. McDeer, Harvard. An inch thick with small print and a few photographs, it had been prepared by some ex-CIA agents in a private intelligence outfit in Bethesda. They were clients of the firm and each year did the investigating for no fee. It was easy work, they said, checking out unsuspecting law students. They learned, for instance, that he preferred to leave the Northeast, that he was holding 3 job offers, 2 in New York and 1 in Chicago, and that the highest offer was $76,000 and the lowest was $68,000. He was in demand. He had been given the opportunity to cheat on a securities exam during his second year. He declined and made the highest grade in the class. 2 months ago, he had been offered cocaine at a law school party. He said no and left when everyone began snorting. He drank an occasional beer, but drinking was expensive and he had no money. He owed close to $23,000 in student loans. He was hungry. Royce McKnight flipped through the dossier and smiled. McDeer was their man. Lamar Quinn was 32 and not yet a partner. He had been brought along to look young and act young and project a youthful image for Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, which in fact was a young firm since most of the partners retired in their late 40s or early 50s with money to burn. He would make partner in this firm. With a 6-figure income guaranteed for the rest of his life, Lamar could enjoy the $1,200 tailored suits that hung so comfortably from his tall, athletic frame. He strolled nonchalantly across the $1,000-a-day suite and poured another cup of decaf. He checked his watch. He glanced at the two partners sitting at the small conference table near the windows. Precisely at 2:30, someone knocked on the door. Lamar looked at the partners, who slid the resume and dossier into an open briefcase. All 3 reached for their jackets. Lamar buttoned his top button and opened the door. "Mitchell McDeer?" he asked, with a huge smile and a hand thrust forward. "Yes." They shook hands violently. "Nice to meet you, Mitchell. I'm Lamar Quinn." "My pleasure. Please, call me Mitch." He stepped inside and quickly surveyed the spacious room. "Sure, Mitch." Lamar grabbed his shoulder and led him across the suite where the partners introduced themselves. They were exceedingly warm and cordial. They offered him coffee, then water. They sat around a shiny mahogany conference table and exchanged pleasantries. McDear unbuttoned his coat and crossed his legs. He was now a seasoned veteran in the search of employment, and he knew they wanted him. He relaxed. With three job offers from three of the most prestigious firms in the country, he did not need this interview, this firm. He could afford to be a little overconfident now. He was there out of curiosity, and he longed for warmer weather. Oliver Lambert, the senior partner, leaned forward on his elbows and took control of the preliminary chit-chat. He was glib and engaging with a mellow, almost professional baritone. At 61, he was the grandfather of the firm and spent most of his time administering and balancing the enormous egos of some of the richest lawyers in the country. He was the counselor, the one the younger associates went to with their troubles. Mr. Lambert also handled the recruiting, and it was his mission to sign Mitchell Y. McDear. "Are you tired of interviewing?" asked Oliver Lambert. "Not really. It's part of it." "Yes, yes," they all agreed. Seemed like yesterday they were interviewing and submitting resumes and scared to death they wouldn't find a job and 3 years of sweat and torture would be down the drain. They knew what he was going through, all right. "May I ask a question?" Mitch asked. "Certainly." "Sure." "Anything." "Why are we interviewing in this hotel room? The other firms interview on campus through the placement office." "Good question." They all nodded and looked at each other and agreed it was a good question. "Perhaps I can answer that, Mitch," said Royce McKnight, the managing partner. "You must understand our firm. We are different, and we take pride in that. We have 41 lawyers, so we are small compared with other firms. We don't hire too many people, about one every other year. We offer the highest salary and fringes in the country, and I'm not exaggerating. So we are very selective. We selected you. The letter you received last month was sent after we screened over 2,000 third-year law students at the best schools. Only one letter was sent. We don't advertise openings and we don't solicit applications. We keep a low profile and we do things differently. That's our explanation."
"Fair enough. What kind of firm is it?"
"Tax. Some securities, real estate and banking, but 80% is tax work. That's why we wanted to meet you, Mitch. You have an incredibly strong tax background."
"Why'd you go to Western Kentucky?" asked Oliver Lambert.
"Simple. They offered me a full scholarship to play football. Had it not been for that, college would have been impossible." "Tell us about your family."
"Why is that important?"
"It's very important to us, Mitch," Royce McKnight said warmly.
"They all say that," thought McDear.
"Okay. My father was killed in the coal mines when I was 7 years old. My mother remarried and lives in Florida. I had two brothers. Rusty was killed in Vietnam. I have a brother named Ray McDear."
"Where is he?"
"I'm afraid that's none of your business."
He stared at Royce McKnight and exposed a mammoth chip on his shoulder. The dossier said little about Ray.
"I'm sorry," the managing partner said softly. "Mitch, our firm is in Memphis," Lamar said. "Does that bother you?"
"Not at all. I'm not fond of cold weather."
"Have you ever been to Memphis?"
"No."
"We'll have you down soon. You'll love it."
Mitch smiled and nodded and played along.
Were these guys serious?
How could he consider such a small firm in such a small town when Wall Street was waiting?
"How are you ranked in your class?" Mr. Lambert asked.
"Top 5."
"Not top 5%, but top 5. That was enough of an answer for all of them. "Top 5 out of 300. He could have said number 3, a fraction away from number two and within striking distance of number one. But he didn't. They came from inferior schools. Chicago, Columbia, and Vanderbilt, as he recalled from a cursory examination of Martindale Hubbell's legal directory. He knew they would not dwell on academics. Why did you select Harvard? Actually, Harvard selected me. I applied at several schools and was accepted everywhere. Harvard offered more financial assistance. I thought it was the best school. Still do. You've done quite well here, Mitch, Mr. Lambert said, admiring the resume. The dossier was in the briefcase, under the table. Thank you. I've worked hard. You made extremely high grades in your tax and securities courses. That's where my interest lies. We've reviewed your writing sample, and it's quite impressive. Thank you. I enjoy research. They nodded and acknowledged this obvious lie. It was part of the ritual. No law student or lawyer in his right mind enjoyed research, yet without fail, every prospective associate professed a deep love for the library. Tell us about your wife, Royce McKnight said almost meekly. They braced for another reprimand. But it was a standard, non-sacred area explored by every firm. Her name is Abby. She has a degree in elementary education from Western Kentucky. We graduated 1 week and got married the next. The past 3 years, she's taught at a private kindergarten near Boston College. And is the marriage... We're very happy. We've known each other since high school. What position did you play? Asked Lamar in the direction of less sensitive matters. Quarterback. I was heavily recruited until I messed up a knee in my last high school game. Everyone disappeared, except Western Kentucky. I played off and on for 4 years, even started some as a junior, but the knee would never hold up. How'd you make straight A's and play football? I put the books first. I don't imagine Western Kentucky is much of an academic school, Lamar blurted with a stupid grin, and immediately wished he could take it back. Lambert and McKnight frowned and acknowledged the mistake. Sort of like Kansas State, Mitch replied. They froze. All of them froze, and for a few seconds stared incredulously at each other. This guy McDear knew Lamar Quinn went to Kansas State. He had never met Lamar Quinn and had no idea who would appear on behalf of the firm and conduct the interview. Yet, he knew. He had gone to Martindale Hubbell's and checked them out. He had read the biographical sketches of all of the 41 lawyers in the firm, and in a split second he had recalled that Lamar Quinn, just one of the 41, had gone to Kansas State. Damn, they were impressed. I guess that came out wrong, Lamar apologized. No problem. Mitch smiled warmly. It was forgotten. Oliver Lambert cleared his throat and decided to get personal again. Mitch, our firm frowns on drinking and chasing women. We're not a bunch of holy rollers, but we put business ahead of everything. We keep low profiles and we work very hard. And we make plenty of money. I can live with all that. We reserve the right to test any member of the firm for drug use. I don't use drugs. Good. What's your religious affiliation? Methodist. Good. You'll find a wide variety in our firm. Catholics, Baptists, Episcopalians. It's really none of our business, but we like to know. We want stable families. Happy lawyers are productive lawyers. That's why we ask these questions. Mitch smiled and nodded. He'd heard this before. The three looked at each other, then at Mitch. This meant they had reached the point in the interview where the interviewee was supposed to ask one or two intelligent questions. Mitch recrossed his legs. Money. That was the big question, particularly how it compared to his other offers. If it isn't enough, thought Mitch, then it was nice to meet you fellas. If the pay is attractive, then we can discuss families and marriages and football and churches. But he knew, like all the other firms, they had to shadow box around the issue until things got awkward, and it was apparent they had discussed everything in the world but money. So, hit them with a soft question first. What type of work will I do initially? They nodded and approved of the question. Lambert and McKnight looked at Lamar. This answer was his. We have something similar to a 2-year apprenticeship, although we don't call it that. We'll send you all over the country to tax seminars. Your education is far from over. You'll spend 2 weeks next winter in Washington at the American Tax Institute. We take great pride in our technical expertise, and the training is continual for all of us. If you want to pursue a master's in taxation, we'll pay for it. As far as practice in law, it won't be very exciting for the first 2 years. You'll do a lot of research and generally boring stuff, but you'll be paid handsomely. How much? Lamar looked at Royce McKnight, who eyed Mitch, and said, "We'll discuss the compensation and other benefits when you come to Memphis." "I want a ballpark figure, or I may not come to Memphis." He smiled, arrogant but cordial. He spoke like a man with 3 job offers. The partners smiled at each other, and Mr. Lambert spoke first. "Okay. A base salary of $80,000 the first year, plus bonuses. $85,000 the second year, plus bonuses. A low-interest mortgage so you can buy a home. 2 country club memberships. And a new BMW. You pick the color, of course." They focused on his lips and waited for the wrinkles to form on his cheeks and the teeth to break through. He tried to conceal a smile, but it was impossible. He chuckled. "That's incredible," he mumbled. "$80,000 in Memphis equaled $120,000 in New York." Did the man say BMW? His Mazda hatchback had 1,000,000 miles on it and for the moment had to be jump-started while he saved for a rebuilt starter. "Plus a few more fringes we'll be glad to discuss in Memphis." Suddenly, he had a strong desire to visit Memphis. Wasn't it by the river? The smile vanished, and he regained his composure. He looked sternly, importantly, at Oliver Lambert and said, as if he'd forgotten about the money and the home and the BMW, "Tell me about your firm." 41 lawyers. Last year we earned more per lawyer than any firm our size or larger. That includes every big firm in the country. We take only rich clients. Corporations, banks, and wealthy people who pay our healthy fees and never complain. We've developed a specialty in international taxation, and it's both exciting and very profitable. We deal only with people who can pay. How long does it take to make partner? On the average, 10 years, and it's a hard 10 years. It's not unusual for our partners to earn $500,000 a year, and most retire before they're 50. You've got to pay your dues, put in 80-hour weeks, but it's worth it when you make partner. Lamar leaned forward. "You don't have to be a partner to earn 6 figures. I've been with the firm 7 years and went over $100,000 4 years ago. Mitch thought about this for a second and figured by the time he was 30, he could be well over $100,000, maybe close to $200,000. At the age of 30. They watched him carefully and knew exactly what he was calculating. "What's an international tax firm doing in Memphis?" he asked. That brought smiles. Mr. Lambert removed his reading glasses and twirled them. "Now that's a good question. Mr. Bendini founded the firm in 1944. He had been a tax lawyer in Philadelphia and had picked up some wealthy clients in the South. He got a wild hair and landed in Memphis. For 25 years, he hired nothing but tax lawyers, and the firm prospered nicely down there. None of us are from Memphis, but we have grown to love it. It's a very pleasant old southern town. By the way, Mr. Bendini died in 1970. How many partners in the firm? 20 active. We try to keep a ratio of one partner for each associate. That's high for the industry, but we like it. Again, we do things differently. All of our partners are multimillionaires by the age of 45, Royce McKnight said. All of them? Yes, sir. We don't guarantee it, but if you join our firm, put in 10 hard years, make partner and put in 10 more years, and you're not a millionaire at the age of 45, you'll be the first in 20 years. That's an impressive statistic. It's an impressive firm, Mitch, Oliver Lambert said. And we're very proud of it. We're a close-knit fraternity. We're small, and we take care of each other. We don't have the cutthroat competition the big firms are famous for. We're very careful whom we hire, and our goal is for each new associate to become a partner as soon as possible. Toward that end, we invest an enormous amount of time and money in ourselves, especially our new people. It is a rare, extremely rare occasion when a lawyer leaves our firm. It is simply unheard of. We go the extra mile to keep careers on track. We want our people happy. We think it is the most profitable way to operate. I have another impressive statistic, Mr. McKnight added. Last year, for firms our size or larger, the average turnover rate among associates was 28%. At Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, it was zero. Year before, zero. It's been a long time since a lawyer left our firm. They watched him carefully to make sure all of this sank in. Each term and each condition of the employment was important, but the permanence, the finality of his acceptance overshadowed all other items on the checklist. They explained as best they could for now. Further explanation would come later. Of course, they knew much more than they could talk about. For instance, his mother lived in a cheap trailer park in Panama City Beach, remarried to a retired truck driver with a violent drinking problem. They knew she had received $41,000 from the mine explosion, squandered most of it, then went crazy after her oldest son was killed in Vietnam. They knew he had been neglected, raised in poverty by his brother Ray, whom they could not find, and some sympathetic relatives. The poverty hurt, and they assumed correctly it had bred the intense desire to succeed. He had worked 30 hours a week at an all-night convenience store while playing football and making perfect grades. They knew he seldom slept. They knew he was hungry. He was their man. "Would you like to come visit us?" asked Oliver Lambert. "When?" asked Mitch, dreaming of a black 318 eye with a sunroof. The ancient Mazda hatchback with three hubcaps and a badly cracked windshield hung in the gutter with its front wheels sideways, aiming at the curb, preventing a roll down the hill. Abby grabbed the door handle on the inside, yanked twice and opened the door. She inserted the key, pressed the clutch, and turned the wheel. The Mazda began a slow roll. As it gained speed, she held her breath, released the clutch, and bit her lip until the unmuffled rotary engine began whining. With three job offers on the table, a new car was 4 months away. She could last. For 3 years they had endured poverty in a two-room student apartment on a campus covered with Porsches and little Mercedes convertibles. For the most part, they had ignored the snubs from the classmates and co-workers in this bastion of East Coast snobbery. They were hillbillies from Kentucky, with few friends. But they had endured and succeeded quite nicely all to themselves. She preferred Chicago to New York, even for a lower salary, largely because it was farther from Boston and closer to Kentucky. But Mitch remained noncommittal, characteristically weighing it all carefully and keeping most of it to himself. She had not been invited to visit New York and Chicago with her husband, and she was tired of guessing. She wanted an answer. She parked illegally on the hill nearest the apartment and walked 2 blocks. Their unit was 1 of 30 in a 2-story red brick rectangle. Abby stood outside her door and fumbled through the purse looking for keys. Suddenly, the door jerked open. He grabbed her, yanked her inside the tiny apartment, threw her on the sofa, and attacked her neck with his lips. She yelled and giggled as arms and legs thrashed about. They kissed. One of those long, wet, 10-minute embraces with groping and fondling and moaning. The kind they had enjoyed as teenagers when kissing was fun and mysterious and the ultimate. "My goodness," she said when they finished. "What's the occasion?" "Do you smell anything?" Mitch asked. She looked away and sniffed. "Well, yes. What is it?" "Chicken chow mein and egg foo young from Wong Boys." "Okay. What's the occasion?" "Plus an expensive bottle of Chablis. It's even got a cork." "What have you done, Mitch?" "Follow me." On the small, painted kitchen table, among the legal pads and casebooks, sat a large bottle of wine and a sack of Chinese food. They shoved the law school paraphernalia aside and spread the food. Mitch opened the wine and filled 2 plastic wine glasses. "I had a great interview today," he said. "Who?" "Remember that firm in Memphis I received a letter from last month?" "Yes." "You weren't too impressed." "That's the one." "I'm very impressed. It's all tax work, and the money looks good."
"How good?"
He ceremoniously dipped chow mein from the container onto both plates, then ripped open the tiny packages of soy sauce. She waited for an answer. He opened another container and began dividing the egg foo young. He sipped his wine and smacked his lips. "How much?" she repeated. "More than Chicago. More than Wall Street." She took a long, deliberate drink of wine and eyed him suspiciously. Her brown eyes narrowed and glowed. The eyebrows lowered and the forehead wrinkled. She waited. "How much?"
"$80,000 first year, plus bonuses. $85,000 second year, plus bonuses."
He said this nonchalantly while studying the celery bits in the chow mein.
$80,000, she repeated.
$80,000, babe. $80,000 in Memphis, Tennessee is about the same as $120,000 in New York.
"Who wants New York?" she asked.
"Plus a low-interest mortgage loan."
That word, mortgage, had not been uttered in the apartment in a long time. In fact, she could not at the moment recall the last discussion about a home or anything related to one. For months now, it had been accepted that they would rent some place until some distant, unimaginable point in the future when they achieved affluence and would then qualify for a large mortgage. She sat her glass of wine on the table and said, matter-of-factly, "I didn't hear that." "A low-interest mortgage loan. The firm loans enough money to buy a house. It's very important to these guys that their associates look prosperous, so they give us money at a much lower rate.
You mean, as in a home? With grass around it and shrubs?
Yep. Not some overpriced apartment in Manhattan, but a 3-bedroom house in the suburbs with a driveway and a 2-car garage where we can park the BMW.
The reaction was delayed by a second or two, but she finally said,
BMW? Who's BMW?
Ours, babe. Our BMW. The firm leases a new one and gives us the keys. It's sort of like a signing bonus for a first-round draft pick. It's worth another $5,000 a year. We pick the color, of course. I think black would be nice. What do you think?
No more clunkers. No more leftovers. No more hand-me-downs, she said as she slowly shook her head.
He crunched on a mouthful of noodles and smiled at her. She was dreaming, he could tell. Probably of furniture and wallpaper and perhaps a pool before too long. And babies. Little dark-eyed children with light brown hair. And there are some other benefits to be discussed later.
I don't understand, Mitch. Why are they so generous?
I asked that question. They're very selective, and they take a lot of pride in paying top dollar. They go for the best and don't mind shelling out the bucks. Their turnover rate is zero. Plus, I think it costs more to entice the top people to Memphis.
It would be closer to home, she said, without looking at him.
I don't have a home. It would be closer to your parents, and that worries me. She deflected this, as she did most of his comments about her family.
You'd be closer to Ray.
He nodded, bit into an egg roll, and imagined her parents' first visit. That sweet moment when they pulled into the driveway in their well-used Cadillac and stared in shock at the new French colonial with 2 new cars in the garage. They would burn with envy and wonder how the poor kid with no family and no status could afford all this at 25 and fresh out of law school. They would force painful smiles and comment on how nice everything was. And before long, Mr. Sutherland would break down and ask how much the house cost. And Mitch would tell him to mind his own business. And it would drive the old man crazy. They'd leave after a short visit and return to Kentucky, where all their friends would hear how great the daughter and the son-in-law were doing down in Memphis. Abby would be sorry they couldn't get along, but wouldn't say much. From the start, they had treated him like a leper. He was so unworthy, they had boycotted the small wedding.
"Have you ever been to Memphis?" he asked.
"Once, when I was a little girl. Some kind of convention for the church. All I remember is the river. They want us to visit."
"Us? You mean I'm invited?"
"Yes. They insist on you coming."
"When?"
"Couple of weeks. They'll fly us down Thursday afternoon for the weekend."
"I like this firm already."
Chapter 2 The 5-story building had been built 100 years earlier by a cotton merchant and his sons after the Reconstruction, during the revival of cotton trading in Memphis. It sat in the middle of Cotton Row on Front Street near the river. Through its halls and doors and across its desks, millions of bales of cotton had been purchased from the Mississippi and Arkansas deltas and sold around the world. Deserted, neglected, then renovated time and again since the First War, it had been purchased for good in 1951 by an aggressive tax lawyer named Anthony Bendini.
He renovated it yet again and began filling it with lawyers. He renamed it the Bendini Building. He pampered the building, indulged it, coddled it, each year adding another layer of luxury to his landmark. He fortified it, sealing doors and windows and hiring armed guards to protect it and its occupants. He added elevators, electronic surveillance, security codes, closed-circuit television, a weight room, a steam room, locker rooms, and a partner's dining room on the fifth floor with a captivating view of the river. In 20 years, he built the richest law firm in Memphis, and, indisputably, the quietest. Secrecy was his passion. Every associate hired by the firm was indoctrinated in the evils of the loose tongue. Everything was confidential. Salaries, perks, advancement, and most especially, clients. Divulging firm business, the young associates were warned, could delay the awarding of the Holy Grail, a partnership. Nothing left the fortress on Front Street. Wives were told not to ask or were lied to. The associates were expected to work hard, keep quiet, and spend their healthy paychecks. They did, without exception. With 41 lawyers, the firm was the fourth largest in Memphis. Its members did not advertise or seek publicity. They were clannish and did not fraternize with other lawyers. Their wives played tennis and bridge and shopped among themselves. Bendini, Lambert, and Locke was a big family of sorts. A rather rich family. At 10 a.m. on a Friday, the firm limo stopped on Front Street and Mr. Mitchell Y. McDear emerged. He politely thanked the driver and watched the vehicle as it drove away. His first limo ride. He stood on the sidewalk next to a streetlight and admired the quaint, picturesque, yet somehow imposing home of the quiet Bendini firm. It was a far cry from the gargantuan steel and glass erections inhabited by New York's finest, or the enormous cylinder he had visited in Chicago. But he instantly knew he would like it. It was less pretentious. It was more like himself. Lamar Quinn walked through the front door and down the steps. He yelled at Mitch and waved him over. He had met them at the airport the night before and checked them into the Peabody, the South's Grand Hotel. "Good morning, Mitch. How was your night?" They shook hands like lost friends. "Very nice. It's a great hotel." "We knew you'd like it. Everybody likes the Peabody." They stepped into the front foyer where a small billboard greeted Mr. Mitchell Y. McDear, the guest of the day. A well-dressed but unattractive receptionist smiled warmly and said her name was Sylvia, and if he needed anything while he was in Memphis, just let her know. He thanked her. Lamar led him to a long hallway where he began the guided tour. He explained the layout of the building and introduced Mitch to various secretaries and paralegals as they walked. In the main library on the second floor, a crowd of lawyers circled the mammoth conference table and consumed pastries and coffee. They became silent when the guest entered. Oliver Lambert greeted Mitch and introduced him to the gang. There were about 20 in all, most of the associates in the firm, and most barely older than the guest. The partners were too busy, Lamar had explained, and would meet him later at a private lunch. He stood at the end of the table as Mr. Lambert called for quiet. "Gentlemen, this is Mitchell McDear. You've all heard about him, and here he is. He is our number one choice this year, our number one draft pick, so to speak. He is being romanced by the big boys in New York and Chicago, and who knows where else. So we have to sell him on our little firm here in Memphis." They smiled and nodded their approval. The guest was embarrassed.
"He will finish at Harvard in 2 months and will graduate with honors. He's an associate editor of the Harvard Law Review."
This made an impression, Mitch could tell.
"He did his undergraduate work at Western Kentucky, where he graduated summa cum laude."
This was not quite as impressive.
"He also played football for 4 years, starting as quarterback his junior year."
Now they were really impressed. A few appeared to be in awe, as if staring at Joe Namath.
The senior partner continued his monologue while Mitch stood awkwardly beside him. He droned on about how selective they had always been and how well Mitch would fit in. Mitch stuffed his hands in his pockets and quit listening. He studied the group. They were young, successful, and affluent. The dress code appeared to be strict, but no different than New York or Chicago. Dark gray or navy wool suits, white or blue cotton button-downs, medium starch, and silk ties. Nothing bold or non-conforming. Maybe a couple of bow ties, but nothing more daring. Neatness was mandatory. No beards, mustaches, or hair over the ears. There were a couple of wimps, but good looks dominated. Mr. Lambert was winding down. "Lamar will give Mitch a tour of our offices, so you'll have a chance to chat with him later. Let's make him welcome. Tonight he and his lovely, and I do mean lovely, wife, Abby, will eat ribs at the rendezvous, and of course, tomorrow night is the firm dinner at my place. I'll ask you to be on your best behavior." He smiled and looked at the guest. "Mitch, if you get tired of Lamar, let me know and we'll get someone more qualified." He shook hands with each one of them again as they left and tried to remember as many names as possible. "Let's start the tour," Lamar said when the room cleared. "This, of course, is a library, and we have identical ones on each of the first 4 floors. We also use them for large meetings. The books vary from floor to floor, so you never know where your research will lead you. We have 2 full-time librarians, and we use microfilm and microfiche extensively. As a rule, we don't do any research outside the building. There are over 100,000 volumes, including every conceivable tax reporting service. That's more than some law schools. If you need a book we don't have, just tell a librarian." They walked past the lengthy conference table and between dozens of rows of books. 100,000 volumes, Mitch mumbled. "Yeah, we spend almost $500,000 a year on upkeep, supplements, and new books. The partners are always griping about it, but they wouldn't think of cutting back. It's one of the largest private law libraries in the country, and we're proud of it."
"It's pretty impressive."
"We try to make research as painless as possible. You know what a bore it is and how much time can be wasted looking for the right materials. You'll spend a lot of time here the first 2 years, so we try to make it pleasant."
Behind a cluttered workbench in a rear corner, one of the librarians introduced himself and gave a brief tour of the computer room, where a dozen terminals stood ready to assist with the latest computerized research. He offered to demonstrate the latest, truly incredible software, but Lamar said they might stop by later.
"He's a nice guy," Lamar said as they left the library. "We pay him $40,000 a year just to keep up with the books. It's amazing."
Truly amazing, thought Mitch.
The second floor was virtually identical to the first, third, and fourth. The center of each floor was filled with secretaries, their desks, file cabinets, copiers, and the other necessary machines. On one side of the open area was the library, and on the other was a configuration of smaller conference rooms and offices.
"You won't see any pretty secretaries," Lamar said softly as they watched them work. it seems to be an unwritten firm rule. Oliver Lambert goes out of his way to hire the oldest and homeliest ones he can find. Of course, some have been here for 20 years and have forgotten more law than we learned in law school. They seem kind of plump, Mitch observed, almost to himself. Yeah, it's part of the overall strategy to encourage us to keep our hands in our pockets. Philandering is strictly forbidden, and, to my knowledge, has never happened. And if it does? Who knows? The secretary would be fired, of course. And I suppose the lawyer would be severely punished. It might cost a partnership. No one wants to find out, especially with this bunch of cows. They dress nice. Don't get me wrong. We hire only the best legal secretaries, and we pay more than any other firm in town. You're looking at the best, not necessarily the prettiest. We require experience and maturity. Lambert won't hire anyone under 30. One per lawyer? Yes, until you're a partner. Then you'll get another, and by then you'll need one. Nathan Locke has 3, all with 20 years' experience, and he keeps them jumping. Where's his office? 4th floor. It's off limits. Mitch started to ask, but didn't. The corner offices were 25 by 25, Lamar explained, and occupied by the most senior partners. Power offices, he called them, with great expectation. They were decorated to each individual's taste, with no expense spared and vacated only at retirement or death, then fought over by the younger partners. Lamar flipped a switch in one, and they stepped inside, closing the door behind them. Nice view, huh? He said as Mitch walked to the windows and looked at the river moving ever so slowly beyond Riverside Drive. How do you get this office? Mitch asked, as he admired a barge inching under the bridge leading to Arkansas. Takes time, and when you get here you'll be very wealthy and very busy, and you won't have time to enjoy the view. Whose is it? Victor Milligan. He's head of tax and a very nice man. Originally from New England, he's been here for 25 years and calls Memphis home. Lamar stuck his hands in his pockets and walked around the room. The hardwood floors and ceilings came with the building over 100 years ago. Most of the building is carpeted, but in a few spots the wood was not damaged. You'll have the option of rugs and carpet when you get here. I like the wood. What about that rug? Some kind of antique Persian. I don't know its history. The desk was used by his great-grandfather, who was a judge of some sort in Rhode Island, or so he says. He's full of crap, and you never know when he's blowing smoke. Where is he? Vacation, I think. Did they tell you about vacations? No. You get 2 weeks a year for the first 5 years. Paid, of course. Then 3 weeks until you become a partner, then you take whatever you want. The firm has a chalet in Vail, a cabin on a lake in Manitoba, and 2 condos on 7 Mile Beach on Grand Cayman Island. They're free, but you need to book early. Partners get priority. After that, it's first come. The Caymans are extremely popular in the firm. It's an international tax haven, and a lot of our trips are written off. I think Milligan's there now, probably scuba diving and calling it business. Through one of his tax courses, Mitch had heard of the Cayman Islands and knew they were somewhere in the Caribbean. He started to ask exactly where, but decided to check it himself. Only 2 weeks, he asked. Yeah? Is that a problem? No, not really. The firms in New York are offering at least 3. He spoke like a discriminating critic of expensive vacations. He wasn't. Except for the 3-day weekend they referred to as a honeymoon and an occasional drive through New England, he had never participated in a vacation and had never left the country.
You can get an additional week, unpaid.
Mitch nodded as though this was acceptable. They left Milligan's office and continued the tour. The hallway ran in a long rectangle with the attorney's offices to the outside, all with windows, sunlight, views. Those with views of the river were more prestigious, Lamar explained, and usually occupied by partners. There were waiting lists. The conference rooms, libraries, and secretarial desks were on the inside of the hallway, away from the windows and distractions. The associates' offices were smaller, 15 by 15, but richly decorated and much more imposing than any associates' offices he had seen in New York or Chicago. The firm spent a small fortune on design consultants, Lamar said. Money, it seemed, grew on trees. The younger lawyers were friendly and talkative and seemed to welcome the interruption. Most gave brief testimonials to the greatness of the firm and of Memphis. The old town kind of grows on you, they kept telling him, but it takes time. They, too, had been recruited by the big boys in Washington and on Wall Street, and they had no regrets. The partners were busier, but just as nice. He had been carefully selected, he was told again and again, and he would fit in. It was his kind of firm. They promised to talk more during lunch. An hour earlier, Kay Quinn had left the kids with the baby nurse and the maid and met Abby for brunch at the Peabody. She was a small-town girl, much like Abby. She had married Lamar after college and lived in Nashville for 3 years while he studied law at Vanderbilt. Lamar made so much money she quit work and had 2 babies in 14 months. Now that she had retired and finished her childbearing, she spent most of her time with the Garden Club and the Heart Fund and the Country Club and the PTA and the church. Despite the money and the affluence, she was modest and unpretentious, and apparently determined to stay that way regardless of her husband's success. Abby found a friend. After croissants and eggs Benedict, they sat in the lobby of the hotel, drinking coffee and watching the ducks swim in circles around the fountain. Kay had suggested a quick tour of Memphis with a late lunch near her home. Maybe some shopping. "Have they mentioned the low-interest loan?" she asked. "Yes, at the first interview." "They'll want you to buy a house when you move here. Most people can't afford a house when they leave law school, so the firm loans you the money at a lower rate and holds the mortgage."
"How low?"
"I don't know. It's been 7 years since we moved here, and we've bought another house since then. It'll be a bargain, believe me. The firm will see to it that you own a home. It's sort of an unwritten rule."
"Why is it so important?"
"Several reasons. First of all, they want you down here. This firm is very selective, and they usually get who they want. But Memphis is not exactly in the spotlight, so they have to offer more. Also, the firm is very demanding, especially on the associates. There's pressure, overwork, 80-hour weeks, and time away from home. It won't be easy on either of you, and the firm knows it. The theory is that a strong marriage means a happy lawyer, and a happy lawyer is a productive lawyer. So, the bottom line is profits. Always profits. And there's another reason. These guys, all guys, no women, take a lot of pride in their wealth, and everyone is expected to look and act affluent. It would be an insult to the firm if an associate was forced to live in an apartment. They want you in a house, and after 5 years in a bigger house,
If we have some time this afternoon, I'll show you some of the partners' homes. When you see them, you won't mind the 80-hour weeks.
I'm used to them now.
That's good. But law school doesn't compare with this. Sometimes they'll work 100 hours a week during tax season.
Abby smiled and shook her head as if this impressed her a great deal.
Do you work?
No. Most of us don't work. The money is there, so we're not forced to, and we get little help with the kids from our husbands. Of course, working is not forbidden.
Forbidden by whom?
The firm.
I would hope not.
Abby repeated the word forbidden to herself, but let it pass. Kay sipped her coffee and watched the ducks. A small boy wandered away from his mother and stood near the fountain.
Do you plan to start a family? Kay asked.
Maybe in a couple of years.
Babies are encouraged.
By whom?
The firm.
Why should the firm care if we have children?
Again, stable families. A new baby is a big deal around the office. They send flowers and gifts to the hospital. You're treated like a queen. Your husband gets a week off, but he'll be too busy to take it. They put $1,000 in a trust fund for college. It's a lot of fun.
Sounds like a big fraternity.
It's more like a big family. Our social life revolves around the firm, and that's important because none of us are from Memphis. We're all transplants.
That's nice. But I don't want anyone telling me when to work and when to quit and when to have children.
Don't worry. They're very protective of each other, but the firm does not meddle.
I'm beginning to wonder.
Relax, Abby. The firm is like a family. They're great people. And Memphis is a wonderful old town to live in and raise kids. The cost of living is much lower and life moves at a slower pace.
You're probably considering the bigger towns.
So did we, but I'll take Memphis any day over the big cities.
Do I get the grand tour?
That's why I'm here. I thought we'd start downtown, then head out east and look at the nicer neighborhoods. Maybe look at some houses and eat lunch at my favorite restaurant.
Sounds like fun.
Kay paid for the coffee as she had the brunch, and they left the Peabody in the Quinn family's new Mercedes. The dining room, as it was simply called, covered the west end of the fifth floor above Riverside Drive and high above the river in the distance. A row of 8-foot windows lined the wall and provided a fascinating view of the tugboats, paddle-wheelers, barges, docks, and bridges. The room was protected turf, a sanctuary for those lawyers talented and ambitious enough to be called partners in the quiet Bendini firm. They gathered each day for lunches prepared by Jessie Francis, a huge, temperamental old black woman, and served by her husband, Roosevelt, who wore white gloves and an odd-fitting, faded, wrinkled hand-me-down tux given to him by Mr. Bendini himself shortly before his death. They also gathered for coffee and donuts some mornings to discuss firm business, and occasionally for a glass of wine in the late afternoon to celebrate a good month or an exceptionally large fee. It was for partners only, and maybe an occasional guest, such as a blue-chip client or prospective recruit. The associates could dine there twice a year, only twice, and records were kept, and then only at the invitation of a partner. Adjacent to the dining room was a small kitchen where Jessie Francis performed, and where she had cooked the first meal for Mr. Bendini and a few others 26 years earlier. For 26 years, she had cooked Southern food and ignored requests to experiment and try dishes she had trouble pronouncing. "Don't eat it if you don't like it," was her standard reply.
Judging from the scraps Roosevelt collected from the tables, the food was eaten and enjoyed immensely. She posted the week's menu on Monday, asked that reservations be made by 10 each day, and held grudges for years if